Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. America recalled. At his general audience, Pope Benedict speaks about his recently concluded pastoral visit to the US, which he says was aimed at encouraging Catholics there to bear consistent witness to the faith. Hunger pangs. As the global food crisis bites deeper, we look at the ethical issues involved and how these price rises are impacting upon the poorest people in developing nations. And high stakes. With the huge growth in gambling, especially online, we find out how the Church is warning people about the addictive nature of this apparently harmless pastime. At his general audience today, Pope Benedict said his recently concluded pastoral trip to the US was meant to encourage Catholics there to bear consistent witness to the faith and carry on the Church's mission, especially with regard to education and concern for the poor. Lydia O'Kane reports.
The Pope's engagements began early on Wednesday with the blessing of a new statue of St. John Leonardi, founder of the Order of the Clerks Regular of the Mother of God of Lucca in Tuscany, who was proclaimed patron of pharmacists in 2006 by Pope Benedict himself. The blessing was a prelude to the 400th anniversary of his death in 1609. Following the blessing, the Holy Father arrived into St. Peter's Square for the Wednesday audience in the familiar white Popemobile, waving to the cheering crowds who had gathered to see him. It was the Pope's first general audience since returning from a recent apostolic journey to the United States, and he took the opportunity to speak about the visit, which was inspired by the theme, Christ Our Hope. He explained what the purpose of the visit was and thanked all those who had made it a success.
Dear brothers and sisters, my recent apostolic journey to the United States and to the United Nations and the United States of America was inspired by the theme, Christ, Our Hope. I am most grateful to all who helped in any way to make the journey a success. My visit was meant to encourage the Catholic community in America, especially our young people, to bear consistent witness to the faith and to carry on the Church's mission, especially with regard to education and concern for the poor. American society traditionally values religious freedom and the need for faith to play its part in building a sound civic life.
The Pope then went on to discuss the various phases of his journey, from the importance of his address to the United Nations in New York to his moving visit to Ground Zero.
In my meetings with President Bush and with Christian leaders and representatives of other religions, I reaffirmed the Church's commitment to cooperation in the service of understanding, peace, and spiritual values. My address to the United Nations stresses the importance of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which grounds respect for human dignity in a universally valid ethical order. In a particular way, my visit to Ground Zero, charged with sober silence and prayer, was a moving testimony to the hope which is stronger than evil and death. I ask all of you to join me in praying that this visit will bear abundant spiritual fruit for the growth of the faith in America and for the unity and peace of the whole human family.
In Italian, the Holy Father also spoke of the American Church's commitment to healing the wounds suffered by the victims of clerical sexual abuse and noted the significance of his meeting with abuse victims and his meeting in the synagogue in New York with Israeli representatives. Following the audience, Pope Benedict was on the move again to the nearby Paul VI Hall, where he received participants of a meeting promoted by the Pontifical Council for Interfaith Dialogue and the Islamic Cultures and Relations Organization of Tehran in Iran. The three-day event, which concluded on Wednesday, was entitled Belief and Reason in Christianity and in Islam, one of the central themes in dialogue between the Holy See and Islamic institutions in countries such as Egypt, Jordan, Libya, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. I'm Lydia O'Kane. There comes a time
when we heed an unprecedented challenge of global proportions that has become a crisis for the world's most vulnerable people. That's how the United Nations has described the dramatic rise in global food prices over the past months that is causing widespread hunger and has sparked violent protests across Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean. The price of wheat, rice, and maize have nearly doubled in the past year, whilst in some countries, prices for milk and meat have more than doubled. The head of the UN World Food Programme called the unprecedented rise in food prices a silent tsunami which is sweeping the world. Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the permanent observer of the Holy See at the United Nations in Geneva. He says this crisis raises many questions about how the international community should respond and why it is so vital that ethical considerations should underpin development policies.
Well, in Accra, during the 12th Ministerial Conference of the UN Development and Trade Organization, over 3,000 people, leaders of the world, ministers, presidents of countries were present, and we debated for 8 days really what would constitute concrete steps to support the development of all the countries of the world, especially the poorest and more forgotten. In this context, the food crisis took up a lot of prominence because of riots that have occurred in countries. So there has been a social and political consequence of the scarcity of food and the increase of prices for basic staples like rice and wheat. This political situation, which is like the tip of the iceberg that shows that there is unhappiness and there are necessities that are not met in the world, has provoked a new reflection on what the international community can do to ensure enough food, basic food supply for everybody. I think that the food, there is food enough in the world, but the distribution of food, the production of food need to be looked at again. In particular, there has been a call for a green revolution in Africa to make Africa self-sufficient in terms of food production. And this is possible because there is enough arable land, water, enough possibilities in the continent to provide food not only for Africa but even beyond. So the question is management of resources, distribution of resources, not hoarding for sake of exaggerated profit, rice or wheat, and then put it back in the market when the necessity is extreme. So we have to balance off a variety of issues in order to come out of this present crisis.
You're talking about these ethical issues of fairer distribution, fairer trade. You talk also about the importance of access to credit and job creation and so on, and the responsibility of foreign companies to assist local entrepreneurs to make trade fairer. And yet these ethical concerns are often the last thing on the minds of those who are seeking cheap labour and raw materials in the developing countries. How do you get this message across to the people who are making the decisions?
Our task is to keep insisting on this important fact that in the long run, an ethical approach to development ensures the success of development itself. So it's not that ethical rules jeopardize or limit the possibility of development. It's the other way around. And it's when there is a clarity of thinking and a sense of responsibility and solidarity with others, a sense of ethical perspective, then development really takes place in a factual and beneficial way.
Archbishop Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the UN, talking to my colleague Philippa Hitchin. But what are the reasons behind these soaring food prices? And how is this crisis impacting on the poorest people in developing countries? To find out more, we spoke to the Deputy Regional Director for Asia of the World Food Programme, Erica Jorgsen, in Bangkok. She says there is no single reason for this crisis, and many factors are contributing to the recent rise in global food prices.
There is not only one answer to what's causing this problem in the price hikes of rice and other food commodities. It's a whole range of answers. But what we see is that globally we produce less than we consume. So there are more people are living in urban areas than in rural areas where people produce food. And what we also see in Asia is, and probably other places in the world, is that the governments have less in storage than they usually have. So those also, there are change in consumption patterns, that people tend to eat more meat and less greens. And I think everybody can figure out that it costs much more to produce 1 kilogram of meat than it costs to produce 1 kilogram of beans, for instance. You have to feed the animals. You have to produce animal feed, etc., etc. And then obviously also the one of the big ones is that biofuel production, ethanol, takes space from food production. So all these put together, and probably also many more, like, you know, there's a lot of speculation at the moment as well. People are making money from higher prices, etc. So you can't say that there's only one cause.
I mean, how concerned should we be about this?
I think we should be very concerned. You can see how poor people who don't have enough already are taking to the streets, and you have seen riots in many countries.
Erica Yorkson of the World Food Programme talking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. Africa is the world's poorest continent, and in a number of countries there, civil strife is exacerbating an already precarious food situation. This is the case in the East African nation of Kenya, where post-election violence that flared up in late December caused around 500,000 people to flee their homes. Kenya's Rift Valley is one of the country's main food-producing areas, but it was also the home to some of the worst violence following the disputed elections. The UN says farmers in the Rift Valley are planting a third less of the land than last year, partly because many of them are still displaced by the violence, but also because the price of fertilizer has nearly tripled. Faris Mugo is an economic analyst for a Jesuit justice and peace organization called Hakimani, based in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. He talked to me about how the rise in food prices there in Kenya has impacted on the poorest people in the local population.
In our survey, 1 year ago, a family used to spend at about 6,000 shillings on food. But now we find a situation the food is up at about 8,000 shillings. When you look at the issues of rice, milk, we see that these have gone up by 34%. So we find that they're spending more on food than what they allocate on education or health.
And how are the poor people that you come into contact with coping with these price hikes? What are they saying? What kind of feedback are you getting?
The feedback that we're finding, it has so many impacts in terms of their own expenditures on non-food items. For example, education. People are resorting to holding the children's back instead of taking them to school to gain basic primary and secondary education. In terms of health, they are resorting to go to traditional faith healers. And also, we look at transport. The international high cost of petroleum is adversely affecting everything in terms of industry, in terms of transport costs. So even the cost of living has about doubled from the last 1 year or so.
I read that partly because of the post-election violence and partly because of this very high hike in the price of fertilizer, that farmers are planting much less food in the Rift Valley. Is this the case?
This is the case, because we have the farmers who are the small-scale farmers who make the bread basket of this country are still in internally displaced persons at the moment. So we don't have any farming going on in the Rift Valley. So first we have to resettle these internally displaced people who are farmers so that we can guarantee our food security. We're looking at in the next 2 or 3 months to have big crisis in this country.
I was talking there to Faris Mugo, an economic analyst in Nairobi.
Money! It's a gas.
More and more people are gambling, largely due to the huge growth in online betting. But how high can the stakes really get? When does a game of roulette cease to be a harmless pastime and become a dangerous compulsion? Well, the answer is far more often than many people think. Figures suggest that a significant percentage of regular gamblers can gradually become addicted to gambling, and this in turn can lead to marriage breakups, domestic violence, child abuse, bankruptcy, and even suicide. I've been finding out more in this special report.
Make no mistake, gambling is an addiction. It can turn into an illness very quickly, and this is what the gambling companies play on.
John Farrelly is a counsellor at Accord, a Catholic marriage support service in Ireland. He has seen with his own eyes how more and more Irish families are coming under pressure due to gambling addictions. Despite the negative impact on families and individuals, the gambling industry is going from strength to strength. Figures show that the global revenue from gambling is growing by nearly 10% a year and is expected to top $100 billion in a couple of years' time. John says Ireland is no exception to this worldwide boom.
It is growing all the time. For example, I'm just thinking in terms of in Dublin at the moment, there's six casinos. Which, you know, not too long ago there was no such thing as a casino. In terms of the online gambling, some of the most profitable companies in Ireland are makers who have now gone online. And I suppose the real hard thing about all this is it's hidden just below the surface. A lot of these companies are offshore companies, and so the profits don't necessarily come back through the Irish books. And so it's really hard to track how much is being spent. But just in terms of people coming to Accord, we know it's becoming an issue for marriage and family.
The Diocese of Calgary in Western Canada is thousands of kilometres away across the ocean from Ireland, but here too there is growing concern about the impact of compulsive gambling. Bishop Frederick Henry is the local bishop, and he has been at the forefront of efforts to speak out about the dangers of getting involved with gambling.
We're seeing more and more anecdotal evidence in particular of just the range of devastation of family life. People are losing their homes, they're losing their cars, they're losing their jobs. They get involved in all kind of nefarious activity in order to support a gambling habit. But as I say, I don't think we should just be looking at it from an individual pathology point of view, but we should be looking at it from a social or public health view. And it's this particular dimension that I think is new, and we're looking at this and starting to say now, what does this do to us as a society? Does the government, in order to avoid the unhealthy subject of taxation, resort to something that's regressive, that we know it doesn't depend upon personal income, but does tend to target those who are weak and vulnerable, frequently the poor and some of the seniors in our society?
John Farrelly explains how even a parent's concern for their children can be secondary to feeding their gambling addiction.
Well, let's put it this way. If you have children, they need to be fed and they need to have shoes on their feet at the very simplest level. When one's addicted to gambling, that can actually become secondary. The gambling can become the primary thing, the preoccupation with the gambling. And at its very worst level, it can mean that it can force children and family into poverty.
And roughly speaking, do we know what percentage of those who gamble do become addicted?
Well, this is the real problem with this area. How it came to us in Accord was we have training on a regular basis, and 5% of people coming to us have problems with addictions. However, we're beginning to notice, even before the stats are out, a number of our counsellors, we would have 300 counsellors, and those counsellors, it really is becoming a problem that they're talking about. And so what you probably find is that it's just below the radar, but it's going to become a problem for society, and particularly Irish society.
I gather that the incidence of online gambling is increasing incredibly fast. Is that the case in Ireland as well?
Yeah, very much so. I suppose the thing is, it's marketed in a way that it's your best friend and it's a bit of fun. The marketing executives and the people who purport this don't sit in the counselling rooms with us.
Too late, scraps, too late away, don't
Just as gambling is increasing in leaps and bounds in many countries, so are the number of compulsive gamblers, who can become so desperate that sometimes they are driven to take their own lives. John again.
I give you an example of a man and a woman that we were seeing. They were surviving, but they had a mortgage out in their house for €500,000. When you talk to them and it unravels. Then you hear about this years and years of taking out another mortgage, and there was no need to. So in about 5 or 6 years, they owed 400 to 500,000. And if that was to continue for another 5 years, you can just imagine how bad that family would be. They were really under pressure. It was really putting their marriage under pressure. But for all the world, there wasn't a problem, but there really, really was.
And do we have any ideas how many families are coming under pressure because one or both of the spouses has a gambling addiction?
It's very hard to put a figure on it, again, because of the stigma around it and also the way the companies market it. But recently, there was an example in Scotland, and the chap spent over 158,000 one night by maxing out 13 credit cards belonging to his parents, and eventually then committed suicide. The real thing here is that there's no structures and processes to control this. What you have is the ability of people who are purely after profit. Really need to keep this in mind. Have no regard for the people, the individuals, or the children involved. And the only thing driving this is the pursuit of profit.
The problem, according to John, is that addiction to gambling is a slow and insidious process that can creep up on its victims unaware.
The thing with an addiction is it slowly, slowly, slowly gets worse, and eventually you end up really in the ha'penny place, for want of a better word. Really what you need to do with any form of addiction is first recognise that the addiction's there and bringing the real facts of the amount of money that is spent. And really with addiction, it very quickly imprints itself on the relationship if you can get both people to be honest about it.
You talked about the fact that gambling is an industry based on profit. Do you think, in fact, that in some ways gambling panders to the worst in human nature, both on the part of the gambler who is looking for riches and, of course, the industry that's looking for profits?
I think so. However, I do believe that society is about the structures and processes we put in place for our people, because human beings are vulnerable at different times in their life. And really it's about the leaders in that community, the government, the church, trying to set, you know, what do we believe in? Obviously there's a free will there for people. However, when you have structures in place in terms of entities and companies, there is no good for society there whatsoever. There has to be some way of looking at this and trying to elicit, you know, what's going on here. But I take your point about it does tap into this idea of the get-rich-quick scheme, the fantasy in terms of gambling and addiction.
Bishop Henry says whilst the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that gambling is not intrinsically wrong, he believes it is morally wrong for a Catholic institution to formally cooperate in an industry that is based on greed.
The Catechism of the Catholic Church very clearly and succinctly expresses Catholic teaching and says that games of chance, whether we're talking about card games or modest wagers, are not in themselves contrary to justice. But they become morally unacceptable when they deprive someone of something that is necessary for their needs or those of others. So there is always something deep inside of us that seems to kind of open up this passion for gambling to become really enslavement, and we know that there are many victims. What has changed, I think, however, in our society is the development of the culture of gambling, where it's become not only part of entertainment, but now it's used by governments and others as a source of significant fundraising rather than by way of taxation, and we've changed the terminology from gambling to gaming to make it more palatable, and in the process we have found that many Catholic institutions even have decided, well, we're going to go along with this because this is easy money for us, and we are now starting to look at the morality from the vantage point of a Catholic institution getting involved in the raising of money through an industry that is morally problematic insofar as it's based on greed and it takes advantage of the weak and the vulnerable in our society.
Bishop Henry has been spearheading a campaign to try to persuade Catholic schools to put an end to the use of casino and bingo fundraising ventures.
The major concerns that we have at this time are government-sponsored, what we call charity casinos, in which the individual schools or societies associated with the schools agree to provide workers who will assist in the actual holding of gambling events through the staffing of the venues and the running of the various games and so on. And this is wherein we have now a proliferation of this, and the individual schools, of course, receive a certain percentage or a certain cut from the revenues that come. So it looks like a win-win all around. The industry itself gets more support. The individual charity needs, whether it's a school or something else, can easily plug into this. And through the working of one or two nights, you can raise $60,000 or more. And one of the things that, of course, has happened is that we see an increasing dependence or reliance upon gambling because it's much easier than trying to raise money in other forms, such as bake sales or individual selling of individual products. But now I think we're moving into a situation where we're really gambling with our kids' futures, and we're setting a bad example for them, and this is now becoming a family policy issue and therefore a significant moral issue.
But how much money is being bet by gamblers? As Bishop Henry explains, it's often an eye-opener to learn just how much each household can spend on gambling.
When you look at an individual household, what it might mean in the life of a Canadian family, is it's interesting to see on a comparative basis where the expenditures are made. So what they have determined, and this is not my figures, but comes from the Vanier Institute of the Family, actual gambling expenditures right now in Canada per household is $1,080. And that is higher than the amount that is spent on education, which is $1,007, and on personal care, which is $834. And it's very close to $1,588 that's spent on health care. So when you just look at the money that is going out and into this particular industry, we have to ask the question, well, what does this redirection of money mean for a family? And I'm afraid that many times not only are certain essentials kind of being overlooked by reason of the promise of perhaps, but many individuals are being affected. And we're not only dealing with the problem gamblers, but we're finding now that we're cannibalizing our local economies or redirecting discretionary spending away from established businesses, traditional charities, alternate forms of entertainment, and contrary to basic needs and support of family life itself.
Gambling is a money spinner for those providing it, and many governments have been quick to capitalize on the revenue that can be generated by the gambling industry. But in Bishop Henry's view, the Canadian government and others should not be seduced by this desire to swell their coffers with the proceeds from gambling profits. And that message, he says, goes for the Catholic Church as well.
I think one of the things that our governments have to do is get out of gambling business. They cannot be the regulator and the promoter and the beneficiary at one and the same time. For the Catholics involved, I think we have to once again emphasize the harm that this is doing to people. And once we begin to kind of put a face and a name to some of the devastating consequences of this and not just regard people as statistics.
Bishop Henry says it's precisely this conflict of interest that is so dangerous.
The gambling industry, including the government, has to promote its product in order to maximize its revenues. And one of the things that they're constantly doing is trying to sanitize the fallout. So, for example, in Canada, it was reported that there were 22 suicides, or when you consider the whole industry in Canada, that can be directly related to gambling. Well, you have a government that's involved in this, and the government is supposed to be protecting people. And yet, at the same time, the government is promoting gambling. And what is an acceptable level of suicide? Is it 22? Is it 50? Is it 1? We're simply not being realistic in terms of understanding that what we are doing to families and people is we're turning them once again into objects. We're trying to recruit new players. We're broadening the base of charitable workers. We're generating more use among existing players. The whole thing is based on greed, and it's exploitive.
That was Bishop Henry of Calgary in Canada, and earlier you heard John Farrelly, a Catholic counsellor in Ireland. I'm Susie Hodges. Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.